Curiosity is powerful. It's the thing that compels us as children to see what lies beyond the safety of our own backyards. As adults, it's what pushes us to leave our familiar surroundings in search of adventure, or answers, or proof of something bigger than ourselves. We want to know what's out there. If life is a cabinet of curiosities, we can't help but to nudge open the doors. In short, we yearn to travel. And it turns out, the world is an even weirder place than we think. I'm Christopher Wynn. This is Strange. In this episode, I'm collaborating with Atlas Obscura, the online magazine about the world's hidden wonders. You'll hear stories from Atlas co-founders Joshua Foer and Dylan Thuris, CEO David Plotz, and associate editor Ella Morton. These are weird, true tales, and they involve places you can actually visit, but not all of them are tourist sites. For example, you'll hear about the Japanese monks who mummified themselves while still alive, and the deep booby-trapped pit on Nova Scotia's Oak Island that may hold secret treasure. We'll tell you how you can sleep in the Massachusetts house where Lizzie Borden may have swung her hatchet, or get up close to the real Amityville Horror in New York. You'll even hear about the psychoanalyst in Maine who believed orgasmic energy could control the weather. Before we get started, let's meet our storytellers. You may know Joshua Foer from his best-selling book, Moonwalking with Einstein, The Art and Science of Remembering Everything. In it, he recounts his unlikely journey as a science journalist who won the 2006 USA Memory Championship. In fact, he set a new record in the Speed Cards event by memorizing the sequence of a deck of 52 cards in 1 minute and 40 seconds. When I asked Joshua if he could still do that today...
Like, with a gun to my head? I'm not even sure I could do it with a gun to my head today, is the truth. I'm a bit out of practice.
Joshua does have other interests, of course. For example, a certain 17th century German Jesuit polymath, which, oddly enough, was how he met co-founder Dylan Thuris.
So, this is Athanasius Kircher, who is, by at least my account and the accounts of some other people, the coolest person who ever lived. He wrote over 30 books on just about every interesting subject in the 17th century. He ran the coolest museum in all of Europe, a cabinet of curiosities in Rome. And I used to have a blog that celebrated this obscure character and tried to surface things that were... that like he might have found cool if he had been alive at the turn of the 21st century. And I wanted to put on an event celebrating this guy's life. And I put out a call on the internet to see if there was anybody who might want to lend a hand and assist me. And I got exactly one response, and it was from Dylan.
Dylan, meanwhile, had been spending his days focused on an entirely different cultural figure.
So Paris Not France was a documentary about Paris Hilton. And I worked on it for about 6 or 7 months, and over that time saw about 500 hours of Miss Hilton, and I think that sort of defined the outer limit of my range. And so I decided I wanted to pursue something that I felt more passionate about. And that's when I found Josh, and we bonded over this love of Athanasius Kircher. And we started thinking about, this event that was oriented around wonder and bringing these kind of incredible people together, performing long-forgotten constructed languages like this language Sol Rissol, and that sort of took us to now.
So that event, obviously everything that you put together was a big success. I remember, in fact, that it was featured in the New Yorker's Talk of the Town, and you guys began brainstorming and working on what is now Atlas Obscura. What was your intention for the project? Did you envision it to become something like what it is today?
Well, I was about to move to Eastern Europe to live in Budapest for a year. And Josh and I just started talking about the kinds of places that we loved in the world. These small museums, crazy outsider art projects, like a 16-story castle that someone builds in their own backyard. And we realized there wasn't a very good resource for finding this stuff. They weren't in normal guidebooks. The books they were in were out of print and didn't necessarily capture the real sense of wonder and joy about these places. So we started talking about making a kind of online repository. And from the very beginning, we realized that to do this, to really make this something great, we needed to sort of open it up to everyone else who was out there, who was like us, who loved finding these places, either when they traveled or in their own sort of backyard. So we decided to create Atlas and make it a user-generated site where people could submit the places that they had been to or knew about that they just felt like, this is an incredible hidden gem. Why doesn't everyone, you know, love this place? Why aren't people flocking to this weird, tiny little museum that's just nuts that this lady has been curating for 20 years? And so that was the real kind of impetus for the site.
In 2014, the guys took it to the next level when they hired David Plotz as their CEO. If you're a podcast junkie, then you already know David well. He hosts the Slate Political Gabfest with Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine and John Dickerson, moderator of CBS's Face the Nation. David was previously the longtime editor-in-chief of Slate. So David stunned a lot of media folks 2 years ago when he announced he was joining Atlas, a relatively small startup.
There was a confluence of factors. First of all, when I left Slate, I was really tired of politics and political journalism. I live in Washington, D.C., and it was just a super demoralizing time to be spending your energy covering politics in such a poisonous, sickening atmosphere. And I wanted something that made me feel better about the world and not worse. I had long loved Atlas Obscura. I'd known about it from the beginning because Josh Foer had been an intern of mine at Slate way back when he was a freshman in college. And I had always admired him and thought he had just an energy and a sense of creativity that was unparalleled. And I actually made a list of people I want to work with. And he was at the top of the list of people I want to work with because I'd always admired him so much. His oldest brother, Frank Foer, longtime editor of The New Republic, is one of my best friends. And I'd known how wonderful Josh was through that. And I loved the site that he and Dylan had created and built and thought, here's something which is giving people a more expansive sense of the world. It's creating a community of explorers. And it touched something in me. And I felt like that the magic that they had created was something I wanted to take it from the relatively small audience that it was and spread it as far as we could spread it.
The big news over at Atlas lately has been the debut of their book, Atlas Obscura, An Explorer's Guide to the World's Hidden Wonders. In fact, it's the source of most of the stories featured in today's show. The world's hidden wonders is a pretty expansive subject. How does an editorial team possibly begin narrowing down what gets in?
You know, so it can be difficult to define what an Atlas Obscura place is. But, you know, you know it when you see it. There are places like Blood Falls in Antarctica, which is this three-story frozen blood-red waterfall leaking primordial ooze. Or, you know, the everlasting lightning storm in Venezuela, which is the site of more lightning strikes than nearly anywhere else in the world, or the Gates of Hell, this giant 300-foot-across flaming pit in Turkmenistan that's been on fire for 40 years. In a way, any one of these places captures a small piece of what Atlas Obscura is. And so the book really serves as a distilled version of that sense of wonder and surprise. And I cannot wait to just sort of hand it to people and say, look at this. This will give you a sense of what we're seeking in the world.
Yes, I defy you to find another guidebook that includes the Gates of Hell.
Yeah.
So David mentioned Ella earlier, and Ella Morton is associate editor with Atlas, and she has spent, you know, at least the last 4 years or so compiling entries and working on the book. Ella, I'm wondering, do you now have an encyclopedic knowledge of the world's strangest places?
I absolutely do. If you develop a desire to go to a medical museum where you can see wax models of dermatological diseases, I can give you maybe 6 or 7 options, which I cannot tell you how delighted that makes me feel, because this is the kind of stuff that I've always been interested in, the strange, the unusual, the uncanny. And this is the kind of stuff that is in the Atlas Obscura book, and it's why I got involved in it. Before I started working on it, I was hosting a show called Rocket Boom NYC, where I went around New York and interviewed people who had something odd going on or something unusual, something unique. And so this was a really good fit for me, and I'm so glad that I got involved in it.
Speaking of Rocket Boom, Google Ella Morton and Cookie Monster.
It was incredible because it was as though he were a real monster. It was basically visiting a place that I'd seen in my childhood for years and years. So it was surreal, but incredible.
I love that. And one thing I wanted to ask you also, I happen to know you're obsessed with old-timey dance styles. So tell me, what's cooler, the swing or the shag?
I love a good shag. It's really bouncy.
Sometimes the strangest journey we can take is inside the human brain. That's something that the eccentric psychoanalyst Wilhelm Reich understood well. He spent his life trying to tap the mind's potential in very unorthodox ways. Here's David Plotz.
A stone building with blue trim, once used as a laboratory, now holds much of the legacy of Wilhelm Reich, a psychoanalyst who believed that orgasmic energy could control the weather. Reich began his career in 1919, working alongside Sigmund Freud in Vienna. Influenced by Freud's theories on libido, Reich became fixated on what he called orgastic potency, the complete release of energy and tension during orgasm. He coined the phrase the sexual revolution. According to Reich, all neuroses and even diseases like cancer result from the inhibition of sexual energy. Reich's work in the 1920s and 30s was unconventional. His vegetotherapy approach involved asking patients to strip to their underwear, after which he brutally massaged them to loosen up what he called their body armor until they screamed or vomited. During a series of bioelectricity experiments, Reich wired patients up to an oscillograph and observed changes in their bioelectricity as they engaged in sexual contact with one another. 2 weeks before the outbreak of the Second World War, Reich escaped Germany and moved to New York. It was here that he declared his discovery of orgone, an omnipresent libidinal life force responsible for gravity, weather patterns, emotions, and health. Reich began building orgone accumulators, wooden booths lined with metal in which a subject could sit naked to absorb orgone energy. He even persuaded Albert Einstein to try one. 10 years later, in accordance with his new belief that the atmospheric accumulation of orgone radiation caused drought, Reich designed a cloud buster. The machine consisted of a row of tubes aimed at the sky, attached to hoses immersed in water. Reich believed that orgone energy would get sucked from the sky, down through the tubes into the water, causing rain. In the mid-1950s, Reich switched his attention to UFOs, which he believed were spraying orgone radiation in an attempt to destroy Earth. He and his son traveled to Arizona, where they used cloud busters as space guns, aiming them at UFOs in an attempt to drain their energy. By this time, Reich had attracted the attention of the FDA, which obtained an injunction to prevent him from shipping orgone accumulators out of Maine, where he then lived. When one of Reich's associates violated the injunction, the FDA ordered the destruction of Reich's accumulators, pamphlets, and books. Reich himself received a 2-year prison sentence. The admitting psychiatrist at Danbury Federal Prison observed him to be experiencing delusions of grandeur. 8 months later, Reich died in his cell after suffering a heart attack. The museum at Organon in Rangeley, Maine, the idyllic site of Reich's lab, contains equipment used in his eccentric experiments, as well as orgone accumulators, personal memorabilia, and the original editions of publications burned by the FDA. Outside, a short walk into the woods, is a cloud buster aimed directly at Reich's tomb.
If you really want to soak up the orgone energy, you can stay at Tamarack, one of the Wilhelm Reich Museum's rental cottages. It was once the living quarters of Reich and his family. If you want a lesson in dedication, look no further than the monks who mummified themselves while still alive. Joshua 4 has the bizarre and fascinating details.
The monks of northern Japan who followed Shugendo, an ancient form of esoteric Buddhism, sought to achieve enlightenment through difficult physical and mental challenges. Between the 11th and 19th centuries, at least 24 monks successfully enacted the most extreme form of self-sacrifice that you can imagine. They brought about their own deaths through slow, excruciating self-mummification. Now, you may say, I've heard of mummification, but how does one go about mummifying oneself? Well, the entire process takes about 10 years. During the first of the three stages, the monks spent 1,000 days eating a strict diet of nothing but nuts and seeds, while taking part in a regimen of rigorous physical activity that stripped them of their body fat. In stage two, the monks restricted their diet even further, consuming only bark, roots, and a tea made from the toxic sap of the urushi tree, a substance that's more conventionally used to lacquer wood. This caused vomiting, sweating, and lots of urination. Achieving the goal of bodily desiccation and ensuring that any maggots attempting to feed on the post-mortem flesh would be poisoned. Finally, a self-mummifying monk would lock himself in a stone tomb 10 feet underground, where he would meditate and recite mantras while sitting in the lotus position. His only connection to the outside world was a bamboo air tube and a bell. Each day, he would ring the bell to indicate that he was still alive. When the bell stopped ringing, the bamboo tube was removed and the tomb sealed. Now, hundreds of monks attempted self-mummification over the centuries, but few were successful. 1,000 days after the final toll of the bell, when the tombs were finally opened for inspection, most bodies had decomposed. These monks were resealed in their tombs, respected for their endurance, but not worshipped, for they had not achieved self-mummification. The monk with the most outlandish story is Tetsu Monkai, who, according to legend, killed multiple samurai and fell in love with a prostitute before joining the seminary in the early 19th century. Newly devoted to a life of self-sacrifice, he castrated himself, hand-delivered his carefully wrapped penis to the lovelorn woman, and cut out his left eye in the hope that it would end an outbreak of ocular disease that had then been ravaging Tokyo. Having decided that he needed to leave his body to the world in order to bring salvation to mankind, he underwent the process of self-mummification. Tetsu Monkai entered his tomb in 1829. His mummy, still in the lotus position, sits on display to this very day at Chorenji Temple on Mount Udono in northern Japan.
A word of obvious advice: do not try this at home. In the 1970s, the makers of the hit TV show The $6 Million Man made a gruesome discovery that would shed light on a notorious outlaw. Here's Ella Morton with the story.
So back in 1976, crew members from this TV show, The $6 Million Man, were getting ready to shoot on location at the Pike Amusement Park in Long Beach, California. And the plan was to capture Steve Austin, who is The $6 Million Man, riding in one of the cars along the track of this spooky ride called the Laughing in the Dark. This was a ghost train type thing, and it featured a tunnel where there were all these ghouls and demons and skeletons, and they would pop up and scare you as your car jolted from side to side in the pitch dark. So while getting this ghost train ride ready for the shoot, a $6 million man employee spotted this mannequin hanging from a noose in the corner of the ghost train. And he reached up for the mannequin's arm to move it, and the arm broke off in his hand. This guy took a closer look at the dismembered limb in his hand, and he was astonished to see that it looked like there was bone, human bone, beneath the desiccated layers of skin. And he realized, this is not a mannequin. This is a man. It was a man named Elmer McCurdy, who was an outlaw who died in a gunfight with police a full 65 years earlier. So way back in 1911, this Elmer McCurdy had robbed a train near a town called Okessa in Oklahoma, and he scored $46 and 2 jugs of whiskey from this brazen act. He headed north, where he holed up in a barnyard on the Kansas border. Police came, they ended up killing him during a shootout in the hay, and his body was taken to a funeral home in Oklahoma, but no one claimed it. So the undertaker there decided to make a little cash from this unclaimed corpse of Elmer McCurdy. He embalmed him, and he allowed visitors to come and view this preserved corpse if they placed a nickel in its mouth. And this went on for 5 years until a carnival runner turned up at the funeral home and claimed to be a long-lost relative of Elmer McCurdy. He requested to take the body so it could be laid to rest properly. Now, of course, this carnival guy was just lying through his teeth. All he wanted was that sweet, money-making corpse to take with him. And within weeks, this corpse was the star attraction of a traveling carnival show. And for the next 60 years, the mummy of Elmer McCurdy, it started to look like jerky, all desiccated, made the rounds of carnivals, it showed up in wax museums, in haunted houses, and then turned up at the Pike in Long Beach, in this ghost train. And of course, by that time, it had been decades. The legend of the outlaw Elmer McCurdy had been long forgotten, and everyone just thought that the body was fake. But then came the discovery during the shooting of the $6 million man. And after that, police managed to identify him. They sent the body to the Summit View Cemetery in Guthrie, Oklahoma, and he was finally laid to rest after all this time. So today, if you go to the cemetery in Oklahoma, you'll see that Elmer McCurdy's grave is marked by a stone that lists his date of death as 1911 and his burial date as 1977. And there is zero explanation for that long gap. But don't worry, his corpse will not go walkabout again. Atop his casket, there is a thick layer of concrete to prevent him from escaping.
If you want to hunt online for the episode of the $6 million man filmed at the park where McCurdy's body was found, it's called Carnival of Spies. The famously odd English philosopher Jeremy Bentham may have died in 1832, but it turns out he still guards his own head. Dylan Thuris explains.
Jeremy Bentham has been sitting in a corridor at the University College London since 1850. Jeremy Bentham was a moral philosopher and is considered the father of utilitarianism, and he was really far ahead of his time. His advocacy of animal welfare, prison reform, universal suffrage, and gay rights were, 400 years ahead of their time. And he left a will with very specific instructions for the treatment of his corpse. He declared that his head would be mummified and his skeleton would be clad in his favorite black suit, and his body would be seated upright on a chair in a wooden cabinet under a placard reading Auto Icon. He also suggested that his corpse could preside over regular meetings of his utilitarian followers. Bentham's plan for his remains became something of an obsession for him. For 10 years prior to his death, he reportedly carried a pair of his glass eyes in his pocket so that embalmers could easily just pop them into his mummified head after his death. Unfortunately, when the time actually came and his head was mummified, something went terribly wrong with the preservation process. Bentham's head took on this kind of mottled, hollow-cheeked look, leathery skin sagging under this pair of intensely blue glass eyes. He sort of looked like a deflated football with eyes. And in order to create a less grotesque display, the preservers at the time created a wax bust of Bentham's head, all pink and rosy-cheeked as he was in life, and screwed it on top of the skeleton, and his mummified head was placed between his legs. And there he sat, undisturbed, until 1975, when a group of mischievous students kidnapped the head and demanded a 100-pound ransom be donated to charity. They only got 10 pounds, but the students caved in and returned Bentham's head to its rightful place between his legs. After a few more pranks, including another kidnapping and the supposed story that his head was used to play football, university administrators decide to remove the head from public display. It now sits in a conservation safe in a special wooden box that takes two keys to open in the Institute of Archaeology, and it is only removed for special occasions.
If you can't visit in person, you can see photographs of Jeremy Bentham's auto icon on the University College London website. A mysterious pit on Oak Island, just off Nova Scotia, has long fascinated treasure hunters. Joshua digs deep into the legend.
There is a deep, booby-trapped pit on an uninhabited island off the coast of Nova Scotia that may hold the Holy Grail. Bear with me for a second. The Ark of the Covenant could also be down there, along with Marie Antoinette's jewels, Blackbeard's pirate treasure, and documents confirming that Francis Bacon was the actual author of Shakespeare's entire oeuvre. Speculation over the contents of the Oak Island pit began in 1795, when three men wandering on the eastern side of the island discovered a circular dent in the ground and a pulley attached to the branch of an adjacent tree. Odd, the men thought, with something buried under there. They decided to grab some shovels and start digging. 2 feet, 5 feet, the pit reached over their head. They reached 10 feet down and discovered something weird. A layer of oak logs. They kept digging. 15 feet, 20 feet, another layer of oak logs. What were they trying to conceal? They kept going. Finally, at 30 feet beneath the surface, the trio abandoned their burrowing. But this is where things started to get really wild. Because stories of the Oak Island money pit had now spread far and wide, attracting treasure hunters from all corners. Subsequent excavations by individuals with eager imaginations uncovered pick marks, coconut fibers, and, most mysteriously, a stone inscribed with illegible symbols. One digger claimed to have deciphered those cryptic inscriptions. 40 feet below, 2 million pounds lie buried. Once the dig reached 90 feet below the surface, the pit began to flood. Attempts to bail out the water resulted in more water rushing in. A trap, the diggers thought, a clever trap to protect the treasure. By 1861, people were literally dying to find the mythical riches that lay below. A boiler burst while workers were draining the hole with a steam-powered pump, mortally scalding one man and causing the pit to collapse again. But as people kept digging, they kept finding reasons to dig even deeper. Bits of metal, bits of spruce, bits of oak. If these weren't invitations to go deeper, what were they? Why were they there? There were more expeditions, 1866, 1893, 1909, 1931, 1935, and on and on. Even FDR tried to sneak away on a presidential visit to Halifax to see the pit. Errol Flynn invested in one of the digs. John Wayne got involved. Despite more than 200 years of treasure hunting, no one has yet solved the mystery of the Oak Island money pit. The likely story that the pit is just a naturally occurring sinkhole devoid of precious relics goes ignored by the treasure hunters who still, to this day, keep burrowing.
Oak Island is privately owned and usually off limits, but the Friends of Oak Island Society offers occasional tours. A 2.6-mile-tall drawing of a naked man in the Australian outback remains a mystery, but it may have a very human origin story. Here's Ella to explain.
In mid-1998, this charter pilot named Trek Smith was flying over the South Australian outback toward the mining town of Coopedy, and he looked out the window and saw something astounding. It was a 2.6-mile-tall drawing of a naked Indigenous man carved into the ground. The man's left arm was raised and he looked ready to launch a hunting stick. Now this figure, which became known as the Maori Man, had been formed by these wide lines dug 10 inches into the ground, and it seemed to have been freshly carved. And it must have required a huge amount of planning, precision, boldness to execute. But once it had been found, no one came forward to claim that they had made it, and apparently no one witnessed its creation. And things only got stranger from there. The Australian media started receiving these anonymous press releases that appeared to have been written from an American perspective, They used American units of measurement. They referred to local places with these awkwardly formal names that no locals would ever use. And they also made reference to the Native American Great Serpent Mound, which is this earth creation in Ohio. And then in June 1999, so a year after this was discovered, a fax that arrived from the UK said that a message had been buried beneath the Maori man's nose. Authorities surrendered to curiosity and dug it up to discover that there was a plaque there that had been decorated with an American flag, the Olympic rings, and a quote about Aboriginal hunting from a 1936 book on Outback Australia. And so it suddenly seemed that maybe Americans did not carve the Maori man. The prime suspect was now this eccentric Australian artist by the name of Bardius Goldberg. At the time, he had been making these Aboriginal-style dot paintings near the desert town of Alice Springs, and he got into a dispute with the traditional landowner, a man by the name of Herman Malbunker. And so to spite him, Goldberg then apparently borrowed a GPS, borrowed a tractor, and carved this huge image into the land in order to get back at Malbunker. Now, we don't know for sure that this is the true story, because unfortunately, Bardius Goldberg died in 2002 before we could get it out of him. He got into a bar fight and he developed septicemia after losing a tooth. So his possible role in this huge artwork has never been confirmed. But when you consider that his other schemes included planting eucalyptus trees in the shape of a giant kangaroo and installing a magically disappearing Virgin Mary in the wall of a house, it seems like he was the only possible culprit. As for what the Maori man looks like now, the lines have faded due to erosion, but the figure is still faintly visible from the air, although the mystery remains technically unsolved.
You can book an aerial tour to see South Australia's Maori Man. A so-called island of the dead south of Venice was once the last stop for thousands of plague victims. The crumbling old mental hospital there still stands and is rumored to be haunted. Here's Dylan with a strange backstory.
The first challenge to visiting Poveia is finding someone to take you there, and it won't be easy. Poveia is an island just south of Venice, and it is strictly off-limits for both locals and tourists alike. And given the island's history, it's easy to understand why. For hundreds of years, Poveia was a dumping ground for the diseased, the dying, and later, the mentally ill. In the early 15th century, it functioned as a quarantine island. Basically, those affected with one of the many Black Death plagues over the years, really any sort of mysterious illness, were taken to the island along with the disease-ridden corpses. It was basically a death sentence. The living shivered and vomited blood while the hundreds of dead were thrown into plague pits and burned. The remains of an estimated 160,000 people are mixed into that island soil. It should also be noted, by the way, that you can see Venice from this island, and Venice can see the island from it. People would have been trapped there with piles of the dead dying themselves and been able to see normal Venetians strolling down the street. In 1922, a psychiatric hospital was opened on the island, and legend holds it that one of the doctors was a sadistic man fond of experimenting on his patients, and he threw himself off of the bell tower after being haunted by the spirits of those who had died on the island. In some versions of the story, he's thrown off the tower, presumably by a vengeful patient. The hospital building, which closed in 1968, is still on Poveia, covered in scaffolding and colonized by trees, rusting bed frames, rotting wood beams, and pieces of the ceiling litter the floors of the hospital. In the bushes surrounding the hospital are the rectangular metal grates that were once fastened to every window, their purpose to keep patients trapped in their rooms until their death.
While the island is officially off-limits to visitors, you may be able to convince a Venetian boat operator to take you. if you're willing to offer enough euros. If you're looking for a chilling place to stay, or in one case, live, then you may want to consider three of America's most infamous murder houses. Ella has the gory details.
So the Standard Hotel is a little bit old hat now. Maybe for a unique overnight stay, you could consider booking a night in the Iowa home where eight people were once slaughtered in their beds. It's available. In 1912, this house belonged to the Moore family, which was a married couple, Josiah and Sarah, and their four young children. On the night of June 9 that year, the family returned from Children's Day services at the local church, accompanied by two of the kids' friends, an 8-year-old girl named Ina and her 12-year-old sister Lena. That's when things started to get terrible. Sometime between midnight and 5 a.m., an unknown person entered the house and murdered everyone inside by striking their head with an axe. And from observations later at the crime scene, it appears that they were all asleep at the time that they were killed, apart from Lena, who had wounds on her arm. It seemed that she fought back. Terrible detail. But over a century later, the case remains unsolved. There was one main suspect, who was this traveling minister, Reverend George Kelly. He'd taught at the church on June 9th, which is the day of the murders, and he'd left town very early the next day. He was tried twice, but he was never convicted. The house where all this terrible stuff went down is now known, rather bluntly, as the Villisca Axe Murder House. And it was purchased in 1994 by Darwin and Martha Lynn and restored to its 1912 state. You can tour this home by day, and you can also spend a night in a room that was once a blood-soaked crime scene. And this is not your only option for a murder house slumber party. There's the Lizzie Borden Bed and Breakfast in Fall River, Massachusetts. It's an 8-room hotel, and the tagline is where everyone is treated like family. Now, ordinarily, that might sound like a good thing, but treated like Borden's family might mean getting a hatchet to the head. This house was the star of the Lizzie Borden murders of 1892. On the morning of August 4th that year, the bodies of Lizzie's father, Andrew, and stepmother, Abby, were found in separate rooms of this family home. Both had been bludgeoned in the head with an axe, and Lizzie, who had been in or near the house during the time of the murders, was arrested a week later and stood trial in June the next year. Now, Lizzie was really annoying to the people who tried her, but even though she incurred the ire of the prosecutors, she got an acquittal. However, the house where all that bloody action went down is now a Borden-themed bed and breakfast. You can stay in the very rooms where her parents took their last gasping breaths. Good night. Sleep tight. Don't let the axe murderer strike. And finally, there is a third murder house out there in Amityville, New York. You can't stay there. It's not officially a hotel, but it is currently for sale. It used to be located at 112 Ocean Avenue. That got changed to 108 Ocean Avenue because of the associations with that infamous address. Why would you not want to buy it and live there? Well, on the evening of November 13th, 1974, 23-year-old Ronald DeFeo Jr. murdered his parents and four younger siblings in that very home. He then went to a bar down the road where he ran in screaming for help, claiming his parents had been shot by a mob hitman. However, when he was brought in for questioning, inconsistencies began to appear in his story, and then the next day, he confessed to the murders. Now, this is not the end of the story. He was given six consecutive sentences of 25 years to life, and after that, a couple, George and Kathy Lutz, and their three children, moved into that house. They stayed there for less than a month before they left because they claimed that paranormal activity had made it impossible to live there. They said they heard mysterious voices, they saw slime oozing from the walls, red glowing eyes appearing in the dark. All of this stuff was dramatized in the 1977 book The Amityville Horror. You may have seen one of the many film adaptations based on that book. But the whole based on a true story thing has never quite been confirmed. You can't currently stay at the Amityville House, but you can purchase it for approximately $850,000 and then stay there for the rest of your life.
One postscript. Shortly after the Amityville house hit the market, it topped Realtor.com's weekly most clicked list. Finally, I'm ending the show today with Dylan Thuris's personal strange story from a trip to Italy. It happened when Thuris and his wife encountered St. Catherine of Bologna.
It can be hard for me to quantify the strange at this point, but I find that there's something about communing with the long dead that is quite affecting. For me, ossuaries, cemeteries, relics, you know, I've spent a lot of time in all of them at this point. But there's one story that has stayed really close to my heart, and it was a visit to the saint relic of Catherine of Bologna. Back when I was living in Hungary and traveling, my wife and I wandered into this Bologna cathedral in midday, and it was a nice respite from the hot sun, and the cathedral was totally empty. Just as my wife and I were about to leave, we noticed that there was this little door with a doorbell next to it. And we were really curious. And so we worked up our courage and we rang the bell. And suddenly the door slid open, but there was no one there. So we slowly wandered back into the small room and then another. And there, sitting in her golden throne as she had been for the last 500 years, was St. Catherine of Bologna. She was still dressed in her habit, and she presented this sort of serene, regal, if long mummified, presence. So we just sat there for a while and kind of communed with this half a millennia old saint. And when it felt like it was time to say goodbye, we stood up and we left.
Strange is produced by Christopher Wynn, that's me, and Jason Reimer, who also wrote our music. The show is mixed at Cigar Box Studios in Dallas. Additional engineering for the show was done at the N Studio in Brooklyn and the Podcast Garage in Boston. Special thanks to David, Josh, Dylan, and Ella with Atlas Obscura for sharing their stories. You can get their new book in all the usual places and read more stories at atlasobscura.com. Special thanks also goes out to Keith Reynolds with Spoke Media and John Lowe's. For more on Strange, or to send me feedback and story suggestions, visit our website, strangepod.com. And if you like the show, please take a moment to rate or review us on iTunes. It really does help others find us. Until next time, thanks for listening. And remember to keep it strange.